I felt very passionate about technology from a young age. I was very fascinated with machines and electronics. And at some point, it dawned on me that computers were like the ultimate kind of machine.
Maxime is a software engineer at a major online retail company. But back in the 90s, she was just an average kid growing up in Montreal.
My mother was a journalist. She worked for Radio Canada, and she was a single mom. Around age 10, it became obvious to me that something was not right with my mom's mental health, and things took kind of a weird turn because I remember my mom starting to complain that the neighbors were really noisy, like that the upstairs neighbor was just making a lot of noise.
Maxime was confused. She didn't hear any of these noises that were bothering her mom.
That was basically the start of the onset of schizophrenia. Like, she's a paranoid schizophrenic.
Maxime's mom's health got worse. Then she lost her job. The family moved into an even smaller apartment. They started to rely on food stamps to survive.
I ended up feeling very isolated. Because we had moved, I had lost contact with all of my friends that I had when I was younger. And I was kind of different from the other kids.
Then something changed.
Around 1997, a friend of mine, you know, got like a free AOL CD in the mail. As one does. Had something like a free 100 hours of internet access. My friend didn't have a computer that could run this CD, so basically, like, he brought it to my house, and we burned through like the 100 hours like super quickly.
AOL Canada launched in 1995. Maxime begged her mom to get internet access at home. They were strapped for cash, so it was a tough sell.
But she knew that I was really interested in technology and that this would be like a great way for me to learn a lot more.
With her mom's blessing, Maxime ordered a dial-up subscription. And very quickly, that investment paid off.
I started meeting friends online. It was easier to be comfortable telling these people things that you wouldn't tell your friends who go to the same school.
Maxime also found videos and resources from all over the world that helped her understand her mom's diagnosis and her own mental health as well.
I was kind of like very interested in learning more about how depression works and ways to treat it. And I found like I could get access to lectures by people who were doing like cutting edge research in the fields.
The internet also just let her be a kid. She was obsessed with video games coming out of America, like Age of Empires and Quake 2.
I enjoyed playing all these games online, and at some point I wanted to, say, upgrade my computer, but I didn't really have any money to do that. But at some point I learned enough about like PCs that my friend's parents in high school would hire me to go and fix their computers.
Maxime wasn't even in college yet, but she was installing routers, upgrading operating systems, you name it. Her friend's parents started sending her real paying clients.
And it became kind of like a side gig that I would do on the weekends to get a little bit of change. So all through high school, you know, we lived in relative poverty, but that kind of forced me to become more resourceful.
Maxime thrived in the online world. She started putting most of her energy into her new obsession, video game programming. She found online message boards and forums where she could learn from people all over the world.
I think their website was gamedev.net. Like they had a bunch of different forums. I was lucky enough to meet someone who became kind of a mentor. And yeah, I feel very thankful for having access to that because it's like through the internet, I could meet people like that who had expertise and patience and were willing to share lots of advice. But like locally in Montreal, like I didn't know anyone who, say, like worked as a programmer professionally, especially not as a kid.
Maxime taught herself programming and was writing advanced code for 3D graphics at just 16 years old. She earned a scholarship to study computer science at McGill University, then got a master's and a PhD in compiler design.
Now I work as a senior staff software engineer at Shopify. But yeah, I guess like the internet was kind of a refuge for me, like find like a little bit of a community, find people to talk to. For me in my life, it's definitely been a net positive for sure.
In the mid-90s, the internet transformed the U.S. and then reshaped the world. But beyond American borders, the way speech is treated online is almost unrecognizable. One of the biggest reasons why? Section 230. I'm Mike Masnick. This is Otherwise Objectionable, the true story of the most misunderstood law on the internet. In this episode, we're zooming way out to get a global perspective.
What that meant was essentially more of a kind of duty of care approach.
What do other countries do differently?
She puts this on the internet. This results in a Swedish prosecution. She is criminally prosecuted.
And how can American platforms operate among this tangled web of laws?
If the law is hostile in Europe to Facebook type of enterprises, then why is Facebook so successful in Europe?
When we last left off, much of the Communications Decency Act was struck down by the Supreme Court. But Section 230 survived, and it laid the legal groundwork for Web 2.0 and the rise of its most popular platforms. But what was going on far away from Silicon Valley? To answer that, meet our tour guide for this episode.
Hi, I'm Anupam Chander. I'm a law professor at Georgetown Law School.
Chander has written some of the most comprehensive studies on global attempts to regulate the internet.
I describe, you know, the rise of Silicon Valley and the way that the rest of the world kind of hampered their own innovation.
Chander claims that Facebook could not have been invented in London, and that's not just because of some abstract idea like American ingenuity.
I think the United States isn't alone in having brilliant engineers. But Mark Zuckerberg, of course, started Facebook famously in 2004. What was it that made it easy for him to launch it here? What I've suggested is that it was the law.
So let's unpack that, starting in Europe.
Legal uncertainty was very different than the United States, which, beginning with the ACLU v. Reno and that line of, you know, really endorsing freedom of expression online and protecting it online through including the platforms that provided the infrastructure for that expression online, it was a vast difference between Europe and the United States, but also the litigation process in Europe and the United States is very different.
We mentioned America's heavy litigation burden in the first episode, but Chander goes deeper.
Europe and much of the rest of the world, if the plaintiff sues and loses, the plaintiff pays the attorney's fees of the loser, which can be very painful for the plaintiff to lose and then have to pay the other side's fees. That's a lot of money, and that depresses litigation. Whereas in the United States, we're a generally much more plaintiff-friendly jurisdiction. In the United States, we have also extensive discovery, which doesn't exist elsewhere.
Chander there is referring to the fact that in America, lawyers get a ton of access to their opponents' deepest secrets. Across the Atlantic, that process is often tightly controlled by judges. Now remember, Ron Wyden and Chris Cox needed to move quickly to pass Section 230 before the explosion of user-generated content could overwhelm online platforms with costly lawsuits. So by the mid-90s, Section 230 was the only internet law of its kind worldwide.
In 1997, Germany passed a law that had a version of Section 230 built into it. This helped inspire what's called the e-commerce directive at the European Union. It offers a similar limited liability regime to that in the United States. But basically, there is a greater sense of a duty of care in the European Union.
Europe has always been more protective of users' information and privacy. Chander points to the first case that fell under Europe's data protection laws as an example.
This is the case of Bodil Lindqvist, who is a Swedish parishioner who, while taking a data processing class, decides to put up a web page to help her fellow parishioners during the catechism.
Bodil wanted to be helpful by collecting stories and resources from the church, but that is not how it was received.
This isn't, someone who is out to get her fellow parishioners, but in the process, she references her fellow members of her community in, quote, mildly humorous terms, unquote. She uses sometimes their full name, and she puts this on the internet. Her church links to this page, and this results in a Swedish prosecution. She is criminally prosecuted, and I kid you not. She notes that one of the people has hurt their foot, and that is revealing sensitive health data, therefore subject to heightened protections and heightened discipline. And so this goes to the European Court of Justice. The European Court of Justice says, yeah, she's guilty, totally guilty. Now, imagine this is what people do every day on Facebook. They post information about their colleagues without asking those colleagues. And so that kind of personal information processing is inherently possibly even a criminal act. Imagine being a platform that carries that.
Could Facebook have survived under that kind of regime? I don't think so. But what about somewhere like Japan? After all, they were a leader in consumer electronics and robotics in the 1990s.
There's a story I tell, which is a case involving a Japanese programmer who puts out a P2P file sharing service. That P2P file sharing service is used by others to share various Hollywood films. So someone is convicted of downloading A Beautiful Mind using this service.
Remember that 2001 film, A Beautiful Mind, with Russell Crowe? Well, downloading it sent someone to jail in Japan. But the guy who hosted the platform, the intermediary, he continued business as usual.
Now he knows, because there's been this criminal conviction, that his service is being used for criminal copyright infringement. But the programmer continues to supply this software after that. And so he is then arrested and charged with intentionally continuing to supply a device that aids and abets copyright infringement. So this is what you face in the rest of the world.
Imagine Mark Zuckerberg transported to Europe. Instead of being showered with billions of dollars in venture capital, he might be prosecuted.
When you carry the speech of others, they are inevitably going to do something wrong. And the thing is that most of the time you won't even know what they're doing that's wrongful. So Facebook needed a shield that would protect them against liability. And of course here, I think Section 230 is a critical foundational piece of that. So that is what kind of gave a huge head start to the American platforms to grow.
But as time passed, there would be challenges to the American reign of big tech abroad. Challenges that might help us think about what the future holds for online speech here in the U.S. Europe and much of the world have worked hard to protect copyrights and user privacy, for better or for worse. Because of that, non-American platforms often collapsed under legal pressure before they could grow, while American companies dominated. But without Section 230, how do those companies operate abroad?
This is a puzzle, right? Because if the law is hostile in Europe to Facebook type of enterprises, then why is Facebook so successful in Europe? And Google as well, and Apple services and Microsoft services, et cetera, et cetera. And so first, I think the most important thing is people love these services. That is, many people find them essential to their lives, right? And so when you are forced to use an inferior version of these services, it's painful.
That doesn't mean they don't try to regulate them, though. Here's one example. In 2010, a man in Spain sued Google because if you searched his name, it brought up an article from 1998 about some money trouble he'd been having back then, which he argued was no longer relevant. And in 2014, the Court of Justice of the European Union agreed. It required online platforms to honor users' requests to remove information that is, quote, inadequate, irrelevant, or excessive in the light of the time that had elapsed, also known as the right to be forgotten. There are other examples.
NetzDG is a Network Enforcement Act, so it was passed in 2017, and it was basically designed to kind of incentivize companies to internet platforms to take down illegal speech. Now, it did very carefully say only certain categories of illegality have to be taken down. There was a very short fuse, that is something like 24 hours to take it down.
In 2019, Facebook was fined 2 million euros for underreporting illegal content under the NetzDG. Surprisingly, many Europeans sided with Facebook and criticized the 24-hour takedown order.
This obviously led to many people concerned that this would, you know, really take down wide swaths of information. And there was a similar law, by the way, passed in France, which fell before a constitutional challenge at the French Constitutional Court, which is kind of interesting. So the Constitutional Court thought that a similar law in France violated French freedom of expression.
The backlash and differing laws by country prompted the EU to create one giant piece of legislation in 2022.
The European Union created a huge apparatus, which has now gone into effect with the Digital Services Act. The DSA is meant to displace those other national laws, and that's DG, is to be no more, and replaced with this other very elaborate system. The Digital Services Act is a very, very complicated statute. It's a very interesting kind of bureaucratization, systematization of speech and speech decision-making. We're already starting to see controversy around the Digital Services Act.
These controversies are exactly what Chris Cox and Ron Wyden saw coming when they wrote Section 230. Online communication being frustrated by the cost and complexity of complying with laws like the DSA.
Now, what might change this whole dynamic, however, are these huge fines that are going to be coming again and again and again. It may become too painful to operate because you have massive fines that are built on percentage of global revenue. It's a remarkable way to set your penalty. It's unique for digital enterprises. As far as I know, we don't typically do our damages based on percentage of global turnover, global revenue, not profit. A company like Twitter may decide, hey, look, you know, this DSA fine is too large to make it worthwhile to operate in Europe. Give up this many subscribers and refuse to pay this fine.
So right now, Europe is tackling the issue with fines that are creating a hassle for platforms, but not going so far as to shut them out completely.
I think in Europe, the platforms are really very valuable, and there isn't really any desire to cut off the platforms.
The same is true for places like Australia.
So Australia realizes that it has to import everything. Right. I myself am not yet persuaded that Australia has created a great innovation or, you know, a better internet experience than we face in the United States.
But not every country has the same priorities. For an example of that, we can look to South America.
So Brazil innovated this Marco Civil about a decade ago, this Bill of Rights for internet users that had very strict requirements of how you could take stuff down, etc. So it was very much a kind of user-oriented approach to the internet regulation.
This came to a head in 2024. When Brazil blocked Elon Musk's X for not complying with their laws. At the time, Brazil was one of the largest markets for X. Brazil's Supreme Court demanded that Musk comply, even freezing the finances of Musk's satellite internet service provider, Starlink.
This is another example of when big tech goes up against a country. If the country is insistent, the country can win, but the country has to be willing to take the possibility of losing that big tech enterprise. And they were in this case. They were willing to go toe-to-toe with Elon Musk. So it's not that these big tech companies can push around countries, as many people think. You can do lots of other things to make it impossible for that platform to operate in that country.
So that's been the strategy. Find companies into compliance or ban them altogether. But there's one place in the world that took an entirely different approach.
South Korea is very interesting because it developed two massive internet platforms without kicking out American internet platforms, Naver and Dom.
The main reason South Korea has been able to do that is cultural.
It's a very safety-oriented country. The level of risk that people have in everyday life is very low relative to the United States. And so this means that there's often, if something goes wrong, there's a kind of backlash that happens. And it's a country that has very serious privacy law. So real name identification or real user identification, because we don't want someone to say something harmful and we want to be able to identify them.
So South Korea has made a trade-off. No hate speech online, but also no anonymous posting. Until recently, there's no way the U.S. would even consider that possibility. But then came the techlash.
We're in this weird moment in the United States when Democrats blamed the internet for Hillary's loss in 2016, and Republicans blamed the internet for Donald's loss in 2020. And so both sides have become disgusted with the internet and therefore kind of laid the ills of the world on the internet's shoulders. And, you know, I think we need to have a more complicated discussion, I kind of feel sometimes a kind of reflexive antipathy towards technology when technology has really done such wonders for us. You know, I just came from a week in China, and not being able to access my Gmail, my Google Maps, not being able to access the New York Times and all the services that I've gotten used to accessing on a kind of hourly basis. All of these things, I think we take for granted. And if we imagine a world without them, well, we don't have to imagine it. We can just move and see that world. And it's not a better world.
I'm a little bit scared of internet regulations because I'm afraid that we're going to end up in a world where you need to show ID to create a social media account and a push to get rid of online anonymity.
That's Maxime again, the Canadian software programmer we heard at the beginning. She says she worries about the ripple effects that regulations would have across the globe.
The internet can still be like an incredibly useful resource. Reddit, for example, is visited by a lot of young teenagers. Some of them might be in a position that's similar to the position I was in when I was a teenager. And you wouldn't want to be like, say, a 14-year-old and have everything be tied back to your name in such a way that your classmates can see what you posted online. So I think if you're someone who's vulnerable and who's looking for help, anonymity is very important just to protect yourself. And whether we like it or not, it's still kind of like the US is like the central hub for all of the internet. If there were to be some broad new regulations that come, it could definitely have like a chilling effect on the rest of the world as well.
America's actions in the tech space will always have an impact. That's always been true. Remember, Section 230 and the Telecommunications Act was the first real internet law on the books. And for years, it served as the global precedent while the rest of the world's courts and lawmakers played catch-up. It's important to remember all of that as we have conversations about repealing, reforming, or retaining Section 230. So next episode, we'll return to the U.S. today. What is the future of the internet? Is there a resolution?
The biggest challenge right now is that AI is swallowing all of tech policy.
You cannot put knowingly your technology in the hands of sex traffickers.
If you were unhappy about illegal activity on the internet, just wait until it can't be moderated at all.